don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
We're only a couple of weeks into the current series of Second Captain Saturday, but I'm sorry to report that Murph's scoring system has already fallen into disrepute. Welcome to the show. Murph, prepare for some serious blowback to last week.
I'm ready. I'm born ready. What have the keyboard warriors had to say for themselves this week?
Nisha O'Carolan, otherwise known as Mowgli Bap from Kneecap, was awarded a shockingly low score of 79 points to leave him trailing Brendan Gleeson in the race to become second captain's greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson of 2024. As one of our listeners, Aidan O'Sullivan, puts it, disgraceful score, it needs investigating. The man got a school's all-star and played senior hurling in Cork. Has anyone from second captains ever passed the schlitter to Sean O'Gohalpin? Ray Wingnut weighs in. Murph himself said he was starstruck by Brendan Gleeson last week. Ridiculous score for Nisha and zero transparency. So Murph, it's sad that it's come to this, but after a full independent review, the complaints against you have been upheld. In order to restore public faith in your scoring system,
this is outrageous.
There will be a reappraisal of Nisha's sporting ability right here on today's show. He will be awarded a score that more accurately reflects his achievements.
That's certainly what you would like. You know, the overlords certainly would like me to just immediately cave to their wishes. But whether I'll do that or not, well, that's open to debate. I'll let process...
You're doing it, aren't you, Murph? You're going to upgrade the score, aren't you?
Listen, I'll let the process take its course. I'm not a dictator. Mm. You know, I'm willing to listen to people as long as it's not unhinged conspiracy theories online on. I mean, I don't know who that tweeter is. I've literally never heard of a school's Ulster. Maybe it's something they do in Ulster.
Well, no, Nisha said he had one. I think it might have been revoked after he decked the Limerick midfielder, Darragh O'Donovan.
am I just going to be a cheerleader for on-field violence, son? Is that what you want?
I'm afraid there has also been some misinformation spread online intended to influence the investigative process. Another listener tweeted that Nisha had won caps in the hurling Shinty International Series. Untrue. That was his brother, Anla. So... Just to get that one on the record there. Sorting out the facts from the fake news has become an increasingly important part of the job for our guest today. Kirsty Wark last month presented her final episode of Newsnight on the BBC after more than 30 years, making her easily the longest serving presenter in the history of the programme. Her forensic interrogations of leading figures like Margaret Thatcher, Tony Blair and Boris Johnson set the gold standard for political interviews and helped cement the status of Newsnight as the programme that shaped political opinion in the UK more than any other. But the Newsnight she's leaving looks quite different. The programme has recently been cut to half an hour, its staff reduced by more than half, and it no longer has its own investigative unit. All of this raises obvious questions, not just about the ability of Newsnight to live up to its own standards, but more generally about what public service broadcasting should look like in the new fractured media picture. These are all questions that we will put to Kirsty, who's also going to talk to us about one of her childhood heroes, Edna O'Brien, who died last Saturday, Murph.
Yeah, I mean, Edna O'Brien was such a polarising figure in this country, but we should remember that she was also a female icon of the second half of the 20th century across the English-speaking world. I mean, so much of what we've read over the last week or so has been about her impact on Ireland and Ireland's impact on her. But, you know, after the volcanic reaction to the release of The Country Girls, she leaned into her reputation and she became a hilarious, whip-smart, scandalous woman in Britain of the 1970s. And we overlook just like what a massive star she was in the Britain at that time and before and after that. Just what a life and what a brilliant writer as well.
I read this week that she wrote The Country Girls in just 3 weeks, apparently, which is roughly how long it takes you to write your weekly Irish Times column.
Well, do the math on that, Owen. That just doesn't add up.
Can you give us a rundown, please, of the leaderboard, complete with a reevaluation of Nisha's points total from last week?
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
All right, Owen, two shows in and Brendan Gleeson, Hollywood superstar and combative full forward for St. Finian's of Swords, leads the way on 83 points. And Nisha, a.k.a. Mowgli Bap, is second, currently on 79 points, but apparently my co-host and production team have read a couple of tweets, surveyed a couple of emails and don't have the stomach for the fight.
More than a couple.
Don't come at me with phrases like zero transparency. I'm as transparent as can be. if you've charmed me, then I'm an easy mark. But if you come in here more handsome, more successful, funnier, and vitally much younger than me, don't be surprised when I decide to punish you for your youthful vigour by possibly underrating your actually very decent sporting pedigree. So you've asked for it on, having once again assessed Nisha's sporting ability, picked out an athlete that I feel most closely resembles him, and re-evaluated the man's sporting achievement. I have now re-awarded Nisha 82 points out of 100. Yeah, he's still in second. Come at me, internet.
Ah, come
I've
on.
Done it twice for him now.
You still couldn't bring yourself to put him above Brendan Gleeson. Unbelievable.
You can try and get blood from a turnip on, but this turnip has been bled just about as much as he's going to allow. So I've done it twice for him now, and I'll do it for Kirsty Wark too. Don't you worry about that, Owen.
Email editor at secondcaptains.com. Tweet us at secondcaptains. Kirsty Wark is on the way after this by Joni Mitchell.
The wind is in from Africa. Last night I couldn't sleep. Oh, you know it sure is hard to leave here, Carrie, but it's really not my home. My fingernails are filthy. I've got beach tar on my feet. And I miss my clean white linen and my fancy French cologne. Oh, Carrie, get out. Oh, you're a mean old daddy, but you're out of sight.
I know our guest will approve of Carrie by Joni Mitchell as our first tune of the day on Second Captain Saturday. Kirsty Wark, as well as being a Joni Mitchell super fan, spent more than three decades in one of the most prestigious roles in British broadcasting. Since presenting her final episode of Newsnight, she has been described as a broadcasting titan, one of the all-time great TV presenters, and my favourite one, Newsnight's smiling assassin. And as a previous winner of the Great British Bake Off, she's already shown the competitive steel required to compete for the second captain's greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson title. Kirsty, you're very welcome to the show.
I'm delighted to be here.
We're having a look at the cake here that you won with in Great British Bake Off. It looks pretty ambitious.
It was the old man of Hoy, but I hadn't actually realised that I would have to bring some kind of scaffolding. And so I don't know who did it. I think somebody had some knitting needles with them or something. I don't know. But anyway, I kind of rammed it all together and then whether it was a seagull or whatever I put on top of it. But it held up for the duration of the competition. That's all I'm saying.
Mm. Are we sure? I mean, are there outtakes that suggest that this thing has collapsed at least four different times? I mean, I'm just looking at pictorial evidence here.
Absolutely no cheating. There was no cheating, and I loved it. It was great fun. And even though it was not like a true competition, but it was for comic relief, it was still pretty pressurized, I have to say.
You presented your final Newsnight a few weeks ago. What were your emotions on the night?
Well, there's a huge amount of kind of thought about these colleagues I've worked with for the last 30 years. We're going to have a big ass party soon. But I think it was just the idea that's 30 years of pretty solid journalism from that program. And it's been an amazing roller coaster because there've been so many extraordinary stories that Newsnight has covered. And so I felt very privileged to have been there and part of it, but I was ready to go. I'd said last October that after the election, I would leave the program. And to be honest, I was kind of worried it might be November. So this way, it was a kind of, you know, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. And I kind of liked that, to be honest. And it was lovely to have, you know, the team said, who would you like to have on your show? And I'd said Alan, who I've known for many years, Alan Cumming, and Jan Ravens, because I thought I'd put her out of a job in Dead Ringers. And Lewis Goodall, who had come onto the program as a young producer. And the funny thing about that was that the first thing he had to do was go out with me to near Westminster for me to do an interview and also do a piece to camera and the grounds, blah, blah, blah. He could not have been more bored if he tried, because really, we all knew then that really what Lewis wanted to do was to be on the telly and be a brilliant political reporter, which he is. And now, of course, he is with news agencies, he's got his own show. And I'm really delighted for him because he is a really great talent. And so I wanted him on because he represented, as it were, a kind of new generation. And I really do think that it, you know, we have to give way to a new generation. I mean, the danger was I was going to start to bed block.
There were former prime ministers lining up to record messages, lots of tributes in the media. Was it a little bit surreal sitting through all that for you?
Yeah, it was a bit surreal. I thought there might be a montage. I thought it might be a couple of minutes, but I never thought it would be that. And to be honest, when I saw Caitlin and James, that was that was when I really sort of thought, I'm going to get emotional. And I hadn't appreciated that I was in the little box in the top corner. The editors in my think, Chrissy, you're on. And I'm like, and then I realized I shouldn't sort of make any kind of strange faces or go, or anything like that. So, yeah, it was a lovely evening, and it was lovely for them to be there. And who knew that Alan Cumming would have seen the Bidens and held a fundraiser for them days before?
Are you missing the thrill of it in the last few weeks? I mean, it has only been a few weeks.
I'm actually very much enjoying being involved as a viewer, and just as a general journalist, listen to what's going on, Kamala Harris and so forth. Obviously, you know, we've got a lot going on in Israel and Lebanon and Iran just now. So I'm enjoying that, but you know, I'm sort of working every single day at the moment, so it's kind of crazy. So I'm filming with Charlene Spitieri and Tammy and Christopher King, because I'm doing this fashion series at the BBC. And then I'm recording a reunion on Tony Blair's first 100 days. So, you know, I'm not letting up, but it'll be fun to have a little bit of a break soon.
In one of the tributes that I read, Kirsty, your sense of joy was mentioned, the joy that you brought to studio and how much you seemed to enjoy what you were doing on TV. Is that a pretty good summation of the secret to your longevity in that job?
I think you have to enjoy it. And actually, I do enjoy very much being in the studio. And I don't know if you know a singer in a band called Swimmers Jackson, Niall. He is actually the floor manager on Newsnight. And you know, he's the kind of person you walk in, and Mary McCreevy, funnily enough, both Irish, you walk in and you go, I'm with my people. Yeah, and so I like that aspect of it very much. And also when things are, you know, if I've been presenting elections or referendums or whatever, what I do is I tend to go into the studio 10 or 15 minutes before and just be peaceful and quiet, because it's a good place to be. It's just away from all the shash and noise, just me in the studio on my own quietly. Yeah, so I've loved, so basically my mantra has been, take the job seriously, but don't take yourself too seriously. And I think that has stood me in good stead.
It's great to have you on this week, Kirsty. We've been hoping to speak to you for a long time now about your career and about Newsnight. It's particularly timely today, though, because we believe one of the people that was an influence on you in the early part of your life and your career was the great Edna O'Brien, who died this day a week ago.
The Country Girls was published in 1970, I think. I was 15, spending time in Ireland quite a bit. Our family used to go on holiday where Dad really could fish, which essentially was Scotland. And then we started to go a bit further afield. And one of the thrills of my childhood was getting on the Stranraer ferry. Hard to believe, I know. But getting on the Stranraer ferry. But the treat was that we got on the night before and there were two cabins. And then we would go to bed and we would wake up in Larne. And then we would either head to Renville, where we went for a couple of years, or we'd go up to Port Salon and Port Nabla. And so I loved being in Ireland. I love all that adventuring when I was little. And so, yeah, I mean, my childhood was spent essentially on beaches with Aran sweaters and Wellingtons.
So was that how you came across your books, by virtue of being in Ireland on your holidays?
I would have been in Ireland on holiday, and it must have been someone there that told me, because I can remember I went back to school in Ayr. I mean, I lived in Kilmarnock, went to school in Ayr, and I asked them to buy the Country Girls, because I had no idea, of course, that it was being banned and thrown about in streets in Ireland and so forth. But, you know, Edna O'Brien, she really was the Queen of Ireland, wasn't she? I mean, she was extraordinary. And after, I've interviewed her several times for the review show, but those books were pretty seminal for my teenage years. I think that, you know, nobody was writing like that for young women, for example. That's what really I thought. And I thought how thrilling that was, how thrilling Baba and Kate's adventures were. And it kind of really resonated with me.
Yeah, and I think young men, you know, there's a long tradition of dangerous books aimed at young men. And, you know, they're kind of seen as rites of passage. But for a woman in the 1960s and 1970s, and for her to run the gauntlet of kind of Catholic Ireland and governmental Ireland as well, as if, well, the two were pretty joined at the hip at that stage. But, you know, dangerous books aimed at women just didn't really exist in any real way until Edna O'Brien came along.
I know. And then, of course, she had to go to London. I mean, and And people still, I think, in Ireland, people still in Ireland, I think, I might be wrong about this. I mean, I think there's probably still a divide over Edna in a way. But I think she was so engaged and witty, and we went out to lunch, I can remember, at Brompton Cross. And she was just so welcoming and charming and interested. I mean, I always think there's people that either transmit or receive. And the thing about Edna was that she received. I mean, she didn't just transmit. She was interested in other people, really interested. And I enjoyed her company really very much. And she was very important, as I said, to that stage in my life. And actually, I reread them, and they're great. Even today, I think they're still a brilliant set of books. The trilogy, the Country Girls trilogy.
Did you say, sorry, that you asked the library in school to start stocking it? Was that it? To start stocking her books?
And then, of course, they came, and then I think suddenly it disappeared from the shelf incredibly quickly.
She said herself, "I'm seen as a genteel, romantic writer, but the reality is I'm a savage writer with a savage eye. I write about the things we are not supposed to speak about." Was it her bravery that drew you to her, or was it the quality of the writing, or a bit of everything?
I think, well, I wasn't really, in a way, I wasn't aware as a teenager of the bravery. I just hadn't read anything like it. But what I think it was the quality of the writing, because it brought this all to life. And, you know, I could imagine walking in, you know, being in a village in rural Ireland, you know, I mean, I think for a while I thought, God, wouldn't it be great to be Irish, to be honest? And as you know, I don't know if you do know, but people from the west of Scotland, well, me anyway, you know, you go to Ireland and you pick up an Irish accent in about 2 seconds. That period of being, I think, from kind of 11 to 16, of spending every summer going to Ireland for holidays, was really a wonderful time in my life, and I did love being there very much. And it turns out, bizarrely, that the second time we were in Renfrew, the first time, Dad had got from the back of the Sunday Times, I think, it was a brother and sister who were living in what we in Scotland would call a black house. You know, it was very low. In Scotland, it would have thatch on it. I don't think it did have thatch on it. But anyway, they moved to the back of the house. The niece was upstairs with a little hairdressing salon, and they rented out 2 rooms and the kitchen to mum and dad, me and my brother. And there was a kind of ruined castle in the next field, and Peter O'Toole and his wife had a kind of very modern house on the point. That was the first year, right? The second year, we went, it was very posh, went to the Renville House Hotel, which I'd never had soda bread and never had mussels. But anyway, the point of the story was, I was telling this to Sebastian Barry, because we were at a book festival together. It turns out he was there the same year. He's exactly the same age as me.
Wow.
Isn't that weird?
It's interesting you talk about kind of the quality of the writing, because, you know, you've said there that Edna is the queen of Ireland in a lot of ways. I mean, that was a very hard-won status for her. And it's actually kind of nice to hear, divorced of all of the censorship rows and the, you know, the book burnings and Jim Graney that might have happened around the time that the book was released, that actually the quality of the book remains long after kind of the row over the scandal that she brought on Irish womanhood has been consigned to history.
And she kept going. That was the thing, because it was Country Girls, Girls with the Green Eyes, Girls with a Married Bliss. And she just kept going, and why not? But the idea that you could be quite, you could have quite a bit of freedom. You know, I came from a small Ayrshire town. Well, not entirely small, it's a kind of country industrial town, Kilmarnock. You know, you're kind of 14, 15, you're going through your own adventures, you know, not quite as Baba and Kate's were. And it was having those voices, those kind of sexual adventures that they sort of had and didn't, if you know what I mean. And it's because teenage years are such a confusing time. And it was that bridge to kind of other books that she provided.
You're listening to the familiar voice of Kirsty Wark. We've lots more to talk about, especially the future of Newsnight. But we started today's chat with the Great British Bake Off. Is this the extent of Kirsty's sporting ability? We'll find out after the break.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
This is Second Captain Saturday with Owen McDevitt and Ciarán Murphy. We're speaking to the brilliant Kirsty Warwick on today's show, who has just hosted her final ever BBC News Night. Was there any reason in particular you decided to step back now, Kirsty?
Are you mad? I mean, literally, I've been there for 31 years almost.
Well, take us back to the very start of your TV career then. Did you always see yourself working in journalism?
I think I probably did. I think what was interesting for me was that my English teacher at school said, you know, bright, but a bit of a problem with application. Maybe she should skip university and go straight into journalism. And because my parents were like, absolutely not. I actually got into drama school. I got into the Royal College of Music and Drama in Glasgow. But again, I mean, I shouldn't have been led to this in a way. My parents said, look, just go to university. I was very young. I was just 17. Go to university and see what you want to do then. And that probably was good advice, because then I applied to the BBC graduate entry scheme when they really hadn't got many women going in, and I got into that.
How did you go from there to presenting Newsnight?
What happened was I was had started as a researcher, then became assistant producer, and then I was starting a new political Sunday morning show, and it had two kind of middle-aged guys presenting it. And we were doing all the checks in the studio for the lighting and all that kind of stuff. And the editor of the department just said, "Just we need you people to go and step in. Could you just go down and step in?" And I was doing mock interviews. I had absolutely no inclination about doing any presenting. At the end of that, they came to me and said, "We would really like you to present this. How do you feel about that?" And I thought,
wow.
Nothing ventured, nothing gained, to be honest. That was what happened. It was purely an accident. And so that's what I did. In the end, I produced that show for a while, which was just a bit odd. There was another producer as well. And then they said to me, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "Okay, I'm going to see what I want to do, maybe presenting for a few years and see how I get on."
That's incredible to almost fall into the presenting side of it. I'm sure subconsciously you were thinking,
no,
this is my big... This
honestly,
is...
genuinely no. But what I do think, seriously, is in a way, having been a producer before has informed presenting, because I think, you know, I kind of see both sides of things.
Yeah, there's your interviewing style as well, which kind of has a producerish element to it. You know, like that I've seen it described as forensic, quiet and steady. There is certainly an element of the producer to that rather than kind of the grandstander.
Sometimes I was just too eager when I was much younger to get in. But actually, and I think that kind of the stealth bomber is better. And I think therefore you just keep going, and there has to be some, you know, heat as well as light. But I think by and large, what I was doing was just trying to ask the questions the audience want to ask. It wasn't about me. I mean, I've seen a lot of grandstanders, and yes, it's very entertaining, and yes, and there's some brilliant journalists to do it, but it's just not me. But I do quite like to have fun in the studio as well. So sometimes it's a very serious political interview, but if it's not, I mean, there's ways in which you want to, in a way, humanize your interviewees, you know. And also, you know, when you're doing a political interview, what's not said, as long as we explore what's not being said, is sometimes as important as what's being said.
Yeah, how do you do that? That's quite a subtle distinction for a viewer to grasp what's not being said.
Well, you just ask maybe the question, then you might ask it another way, and then you say, okay, you know, you've dug as much as you can. And they're obviously hiding something. So, you know, maybe I can't find out what they're hiding right now, but we will eventually find out what they're hiding.
The news night that you joined and helped shape over the 90s and 2000s, did you feel in that era there was a pressure almost, or there was a sense of obligation, there was a public duty maybe for cabinet ministers, the very top politicians, to go on that show and be interrogated?
I think that... Well, what I've always thought, actually, is that people that actually are good at their job are more likely to come on, in a way, because they're more confident. I don't mean confident in a bad way. I mean, I think there's some really dedicated politicians. And I think that they would come on, and there were less opportunities for them to go elsewhere. Now that has changed. Social media, they're TikToking all over the place. You know, sometimes they don't want to be interrogated. But actually, I think, and this is actually something a politician said to me, is a tougher interview is better for them than a soft one.
In what way?
Because they have to be on their mettle. And if they're on their mettle and can as well be deliver, and then they have a better standing. You know, so someone that comes on and just faffs about and tries to be smart and is a bit stupid, they're not winning themselves any brownie points.
Michael Crick, Newsnight's former political editor, had an interesting take. Gradually, ministers and their advisors realized they didn't have to submit themselves to potentially career-wrecking interrogations by Paxman and Wark. Are you victims of your own success in a way?
No, because I think that's the job we have to keep doing. Because if we tempered our questions and tempered our approach, that would be seen as, in a way, toadying, you know. But I do think that, I do think that there are other avenues for them now. So it's just a case of just trying to make sure that we do keep getting key players on the program. The program is being shaped differently now. It is a different kind of program. But politicians know they have to be held to account. You know, so it's all very well for them to TikTok, as I say, or to put social media stuff out. You know, I never interviewed Boris Johnson as Prime Minister. I interviewed him before. I remember I interviewed him when he was a kind of outlander MP, and he kept making allusions to, he just kept buffooning on about making allusions to, you know, Greek mythology. And in the end, you know, really, it's not very illuminating for the audience, and actually it's a bit of an insult for the audience.
Has the dynamic of these interviews changed in recent years, though, post-Brexit particularly? Are politicians more comfortable coming into that arena and basically lying to your face?
I'm not sure they're lying to my face. They may well be, but I think if they are, and if they're not, if they're dissembling, then that's my point really about the forensic interview, is that what you do is you show that they're dissembling. You put facts to them, you know, and if they fail to answer about these facts, they're dissembling. So the chances are they're not being wholly truthful.
Alternative facts is a phrase that has entered the lexicon, though. I mean, you can have an argument with someone if you can agree on the basic facts, but it's surely an unsatisfactory interview if you know that the other person is dissembling, is lying, basically, because the facts don't fit their narrative.
Well, facts are facts, and you know, we fact check before interviews, right? So we're not going to put false information into questions. So there's a way exactly in that where what you're doing is you're exposing these supposed alternative facts. Now, there could be a matter of opinion about the impact of something, but you know, there are only facts. And that's what journalism is about, is checking your facts and exposing politicians if they try and put forward alternative facts.
We live in a world now where government ministers, the previous government ministers, openly accused the BBC of bias. I mean, has this approach worked? Do you get any sense that the BBC is less trusted now than it was 5 or 10 years ago?
No, I genuinely don't, because I think we've kind of doubled down to make sure that we aren't ever, well, touch wood, that you know, we're not promoting one side or the other. You know, that's the thing. And you know, that, to be honest, that's quite easy to do because you do have the information. And, you know, if you're a sentient being in many ways, you will have a political view on something. But I find it incredibly easy to leave that stuff at the door. Incredibly easy, because you're just trained. And it is about training, years of training. And that's what I've actually loved watching young producers, journalists grow on Newsnight, is they get that and they understand that. And in a way, I'm very heartened by the kind of caliber in terms of journalism.
Can that impartiality and balance be part of the problem, though? I heard Emily Maitlis, your former colleague, make a point recently that, for example, around Brexit, it would take Newsnight 5 minutes to find 60 economists who feared the effects of Brexit. It might take 6 hours to find one economist in favour of Brexit. And her argument is that by presenting one of each, you're reaching
false equivalence.
She called it a superficial balance. It reaches a superficial balance while obscuring a deeper truth. Is that an issue that you have to grapple with?
Well, it's an issue you have to be upfront about. And it's about showing your workings. And to Emily's point, you know, we say, you know, tonight we have on X, you know, and you just literally say, you know, it was very hard to find somebody who would support this position on Brexit. It was very, it wasn't hard to find someone, an economist, and we've been through lots of economists. And that's what I think we have to be very honest with the audience, and that's what we weren't doing before. So I agree. I think the false equivalence is wrong. I think we need to say that, you know, that there is a whole people, you know, there's a mass on this side which believe this, but there's not on this side. But we have to have that voice in the programme.
Obviously, in this climate, a strong news night is needed. It's vital. But the show's former political editor, Michael Crick, said that with the new format, what we'll be left with is yet another talk show in a world overwhelmed by TV talking shops. Do you see his point?
I know what Michael means, but I think, again, as long as you have people that are of the top caliber on the show, then you will keep the audience. And also, you know, when big stories happen, people know to turn on, you know, the, or turn over from the 10 to Newsnight. So, you know, if you've got things happening in real time, like Kamala Harris making an incredible speech or Biden standing down, all these things happening, then people will always, they know they will get the top analysis on Newsnight, and that's what you hope for. It's not perfect, but actually I think we've made a pretty good fist of it. And I will be honest, you know, there is a real problem with finances. You know, people are going different places to, will there still be a license fee? We just don't know. Obviously, we hope there'll be a license fee. But the broadcasting landscape's changing. And as I say, if you can have a kind of crack team on Newsnight, albeit a small and perfectly formed one, then you will keep the audience. And that's what's happened so far. And actually, I think Jonathan Aspinall, the editor, has done pretty well on that.
All right, Kirsty, the time has come for us to start making a case for you to be our greatest non-sportsperson of 2024. Now, former BBC presenters Gabby Logan was a series champion a few years back. Orla Gearan, on the other hand, what was Orla's claim to fame, Murph?
She went through a lot of passports.
Goodness,
that was big, which, you know.
Okay, I play pretty good table tennis. I was the badminton champion for a year at school. I'm very bad at hockey. I adore tennis. I'm starting to play pickleball. What more do you want?
No, well, hang on. There's a lot
well,
there.
I mean, we could forget Orla Gearan straight off anyway. I think we could choke that one down.
So tennis is the big one.
Tennis is the big one. I remember as a kid, I would stay with my grandfather for a couple of weeks each year. And at the side of his house, there was this huge wall. And the roads were quite quiet then. So I would chalk a line, because it was always during Wimbledon. I would chalk a line along the wall and I would just bang balls against the wall like for hours on end. And then I would go inside and watch in Wimbledon in black and white with Rod Laver and Margaret Court. And that's sort of cemented my love of tennis, which I've had my whole life, but I've never really been particularly great at it, I would say. In fact, I've not been actually hugely good, but I've been consistently playing it for years.
So what are we talking about? More of a Andre Agassi baseliner or
we're talking a lot of baseline, but I'm actually, to be honest, the older I get, I'm much better than it. And also I've got a huge advantage because I'm a left-hander. I absolutely love it. I love it. I love singles, but I now love doubles probably more. And I just love the entertainment of it. And also, you know, I play with three other women on a Sunday morning. And, you know, we play for maybe, you know, we do a set. Then we stand at the net and chat a bit. Then we go back out and play again. So and then we're going for a coffee, chat a bit more, talk about playing pickleball. But the idea is that by end of September, also I've got into a rhythm of doing front row on Radio 4 on Wednesday night and some documentaries. But I'll spend more time not doing that. I've got a novel to finish and I've got other stuff to do. So,
but after that, then the tennis takes over. Is that what you're saying? Get this novel out of the way. Get these Radio 4 shows.
I'm going back for some more tennis lessons.
Tennis lessons?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Russ never sleeps. I need to get my game a bit better. If I don't get it better in this decade, it's not going to be better.
You mentioned being a badminton champion.
But that was only because I wanted to. I love badminton, actually. And but it's a bit weird with the shuttlecock being so like non-resistant. It's kind of strange. Whereas I really like to thwack. And that's where pickleball comes in. It's a really fast-growing sport.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of tennis OGs actually despise pickleball. I mean, you're obviously open to new experiences in a way that perhaps the tennis establishment would look down upon.
Yeah, absolutely. There's paddleball, there's pickleball. Yeah, I didn't know whether I'd like pickleball too, but the reactions have to be incredibly fast. And And there's some weird arcane kind of rules. But I quite like all that.
Something we need to talk about here is your school marching, which is not yes. an activity I'm even familiar with. So you'll have to explain this for our listeners.
Okay. My school was divided into four houses, girls' school. And it was women. So it was Marie Curie, Nightingale. Mind you, it was Churchill. Certainly was a woman. I can't even remember the other one. In the end of the school year, we would go to Racecourse Road in Ayr, big field. And there was our Dan Park Stadium, in fact, and there was a marching cup as part of the school sports. And so you had to have your sand shoes whitened. You'd been drilled by the head of house, who were often, I always talked about as being institutional bullying. And then you were to march along and you would get a marching cup. Not individually, but for your house.
That's good enough. Listen, we have to ask you for your sporting highlight before we rank your sporting life here. It's got to be Bake Off, hasn't it? I mean, not many people win Celebrity Bake Off in the style that you won.
I did love doing that. And yeah, I love baking. I used to, you know, when I was wee in London when the kids were small, I mean, the kids just talk about this, well, they're now in their early 30s, but talk about this, that you would come home and the first thing you would do is bake something just to sort of feel you were back home and being that nurturing mother you clearly had been during the week.
I read that you had never made the cake before. You just cobbled it together on the day. I'll read up. You cut up two big Madeira sponges into squares, spreading jam and buttercream between the layers and covering it in sandstone-coloured soft cheese frosting.
Sounds pretty good to me.
I mean, I just think that's like, you know, absolutely crack architecture, frankly.
Yeah. There was, of course, the Celebrity MasterChef scandal.
No, we can't. That's
robbed by England rugby player Phil Vickery. Now, I do believe there was a raspberry creme brulee issue that maybe is best left and lost to the sands of time.
Yeah, but do you know what? Phil Vickery is a brilliant cook.
Oh, okay, Kirstie is clearly refusing to expand on her terrible raspberry creme brulee mishap. This may work against her. We've heard enough. Murph, will you please rank this sporting life of Kirsty Wark?
You don't understand. I could have had class.
We don't have stars in this game, Mrs. Weaver.
What do you have, then?
People like me.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
So, Kirsty, we've had a delightful afternoon, but much like a politician having to swallow their pride and face their electorate once every 5 years, the time has come for me to assess your all-time sporting highlight, pick an athlete that I feel most closely resembles you and your sporting achievements, and then present you with a score out of 100 to discover if you can be crowned our top non-sportsperson sportsperson for 2024. You're a relentless competitor in the very best Scottish tradition. You managed to put a 2011 Celebrity MasterChef loss behind you to win a Great British Bake Off comic relief special in 2013, an example of durability and mental strength that, yes, Andy Murray himself would be proud of. I got to give you a lot of credit for leaving the most high-profile job in British broadcasting, at least in part, to focus on your tennis career, obviously. Now, that's going to get you some points. Now, however, we must get to the nub of the problem. Is competitive food preparation actually a sport, though? Really? I've gone back and forth on this quite a bit. On the one hand, obviously not, and you should, by the letter of the law, be awarded precisely no points for it. But who are we to cast aspersions? After all, Ireland's first Olympic medal came in painting, for God's sake, won by Jack B. Yeats in Paris 100 years ago this month. And next week, breakdancing is going to be featuring at the Olympics, so what the hell do we know? I'm prepared to accept it, even if you remain tight-lipped about what exactly went on in that face-off with Phil Vickery. And your marching pedigree would also endear you to at least portions of the population on this island, and we can't disregard that either. All in all, I think it's been a solid showing. Good enough, in fact, for 75 points and a top three placings as things stand 3 weeks into this year's competition. Kirsty Wark, this has been your sporting life.
Are you happy enough with that, Mark, Kirsty?
I am pretty happy with that. It's a solid 75. I'd like an 80, but, you know, maybe you just don't like pickleball.
And absolutely brilliant to have you on. Round of applause, please, for Kirsty Wark. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Aw Shoot, the latest single from the amazing C-Mat. Her second album, Crazy Mad For Me, was shortlisted for the Mercury Prize earlier this week, and she clarified on Twitter that the M in C-Mat actually stands for Mercury Prize, which bodes well for her chances. We heard her on the Off Menu podcast recently. She was talking about how she was not happy, Murph, that Trevor Brennan has his own dedicated trophy cabinet in her local pub, Brady's of Dunboyne, rather than her. No. Especially Trevor isn't even from Dunboyne. So C-Mat, it's a disgrace. If you're listening, come on the show. Let's talk about this injustice. We're big fans. We'll get Trevor on too, if you like. Whatever works for you. Yeah. Never mind the Mercury. Our greatest non-sportsperson title is the prize you should be after.
Normally, I would frown on this level of fawning, but it's for C-Mat, so I 100% endorse it. I've heard that podcast as well. She's hilarious. So come on. What's the worst that could happen? I mean, I could award you way less points than you deserve, and we get tons of emails about it.
Sounds like if C-Mat's coming on, she's getting close to 100 points, Murph, by the way you're talking there. You poor fella, though. You were clearly shaken by the reaction to your treatment of Mowgli Bapp last week. You've made the classic mistake of overcompensating by giving 75 points to a guest whose sporting highlight is winning a charity baking competition. A baking competition that was watched by millions of viewers, fair enough, but a baking competition nonetheless. You've cracked, Ciarán. I've no doubt further guests will sense your weakness.
That's the price you pay, you know. You try to be an empathetic, warm-hearted person, and this is what happens.
We could have a super Saturday ahead of us at the Olympics today. This afternoon, Reese McLenaghan is going for gold in the pommel horse final at 4:15. And he's going to get it too, Murph. The rest of us might still be mentally scarred by the last Olympics when a misplaced finger cost him his shot at title. He is not. He's been pretty good at erasing that from his mind. He's won back-to-back world championships since then. And we've interviewed the man. Like a lot of our young Olympians this year, he is a confident fella in the best sense of the word. And I feel he's going to get the job done. So Reese is getting gold. Chalk that down. It's another one to go with Daniel Whiff and Paul O'Donovan and Fintan McCarthy after their heroics yesterday. Then a little after 9 o'clock tonight, Kelly Harrington, already guaranteed a bronze, can upgrade that to at least a silver if she gets a better of Beatrice Ferreira, the same opponent you may remember she beat in a cracking Olympic final last time out. Ferreira's turned professional since Tokyo. She's become a world champion. She hasn't forgotten what happened in Tokyo, though. After winning her world title, she said she was desperate to fight Kelly again, and it will definitely go the other way this time around. Don't think that's going to spook Kelly too much, to be perfectly honest with you.
No, it's been a mad week, a brilliant week of sport, but I like the sound of an Olympic Super Saturday for Ireland. I like that a lot.
No, that fight tonight would be well worth watching. Hopefully more Irish medals to celebrate on Saturday Sport today. You can hear our own Olympics coverage throughout the week on secondcaptains.com. This has been Second Captains production for RTE. Thank you to Killian Down for producing today. Mark Horgan is the series producer for Second Captains. Thanks to Johnny Lanagan in RTE. Thank you, Murph, for being the bigger man today, doing what needed to be done with regards to last week's controversy. Thank you.
Thank you, Aud.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.